Welcome to the Boston College Chief Executives Club podcast of the September 24, 2020 forum featuring Robin Hayes, CEO of JetBlue. I'm Warren Zola. The Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management, is one of the top-ranked CEO speaking forums in the world. Several times each year, Boston's business leaders gather to learn from CEOs of global companies, leaders from the top echelons of their fields, who welcome the opportunity to address an audience of their peers. Robin Hayes joined us for a series we call Conversations with CEOs, as he spoke with our executive director, Warren Zola, and engaged in a Q&A with our members. The conversation focused on JetBlue's response to COVID-19, the future of air travel and new routes, sustainability, and their dedication to diversity inclusion. Please enjoy this podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club. Welcome, everybody. On behalf of Boston College and the Carroll School of Management, welcome to the Boston College Chief Executives Club session, Conversations with CEOs. Today, we are thrilled that JetBlue CEO Robin Hayes has joined us. I've been watching too much Princess Bride lately with my family. Robin Hayes has joined us, as well as our host for the day, managing partner and governor of the Boston Celtics, Wick Grosbeck. So thank you both for joining us. Wick, I'll turn it over to you to do a brief intro of Robin.
Thank you very much, Warren. And hello, Robin. And hello to everybody. This is what the bubble looks like. This is the bubble, the NBA bubble. And it's my great pleasure and honor to be able to introduce Robin Hayes, the CEO of JetBlue. He's known as a resolute, effective, energetic CEO, born in London, raised in London, educated over there, and joined British Airways for a number of years. And I think we all know, especially back in the day, British Airways had a special shine to it, a special reverence people felt for it as a really quality airline. And then he took that experience, which he helped create, and joined JetBlue in 2008 in a senior role, and became president in 2014 and the CEO in 2015. And as one of his first, I think, really visionary decisions, he became the official airline of the Boston Celtics in 2016, which we greatly appreciate. And in fact, just going the extra mile, Robin and his team sent the Celtics liveried A320, a beautiful plane called Lucky Blue. It's a green Celtics plane, which many of you have seen at Logan, I'm sure, or elsewhere. Sent it down here to Orlando to support the guys and gather some attention before our Game 7, which we won the other night. So that really was very much appreciated by everybody. But I note with some pride, in fact, or some admiration, that JetBlue is rated at the very top of moderately priced airlines, the very top of airlines in terms of customer satisfaction. I do fly JetBlue. I feel good about it. I feel well taken care of, well entertained, great staff attitudes, and I feel like the whole proposition is fair and reasonable. And I think people respond to that, especially these days. And so you've really helped build in are running something that's very, very special. I'd also like to add that when you came in as partners with the Celtics in 2016, your team made it very clear how important the community was to you. And together, as part of our partnership, we're not just linking our brands in business, but in the community. We've renovated STEM labs together, donated computers. You have donated computers and time and staff time together with us, and we've done, I think, meaningful work, which I'm very appreciative of, together in the community. So it's very important to me to recognize that, because it's an authentic part of doing business with JetBlue, which we appreciate. I'm looking forward to hearing your remarks, especially during this difficult pandemic time. I note with happiness for you that your stock has just about doubled since sort of the early scary days of the pandemic. So you're going the right direction. There's more work to do, no doubt. But if I were going to bet on anybody in the business, and I guess I am, I'd bet on you guys. So welcome, Robin, and looking forward to your remarks.
Thanks, Wick. Thanks, Warren. It's so So exciting to be with you today and all of our friends in Boston, and good luck with the games. I mean, I think we take all the credit for you winning game seven. I think it was just the airplane. I don't think the players had much
to do. You could send it down really quickly. Yeah. We've got a key game tomorrow.
Oh, I know. No, so I'm just pleased that Bubble's going so well and you're doing so well. And truly, we appreciate the partnership with the Celtics very much. You know, we have thousands of people that work for us in Boston, and everyone's a sports fan. And, you know, where's in New York, right? It's there are different teams that you can support. In Boston, everyone supports the same team. And so really excited to have had that partnership with the Celtics for so many years now, and being part of the Boston community. And I remember touring BC once when my kid was looking to apply for college. He didn't go there in the end, but it's just such a beautiful place. And we have a number of BC grads working at JetBlue, and they're just super people.
Well, wonderful. And we hope that the invitation for you to come visit Boston and Boston College and maybe attend a Celtics game in the future is still there. So we look forward to things opening up and having you here in person in Boston. So at this point, I'm going to turn Wick's video off. He will join us for the lightning round of questions at the end. And Robin, I turn to you. And when I was doing research a little bit on JetBlue and yourself, your team was very eager to say that you have spent and started your career here in Boston. So it's a familiar place for you.
I did, you know, when I was graduating university, I decided that I wanted to go and spend a summer working in the States. So we all flew to New York on an airline called Pan Am back then. We had a sort of a orientation plan in New York where they tried to, in 3 hours, teach Brits the cultural difference between being a Brit and being an American. And the thing I most remember for that is just if someone asks you if you'd like something in America, if you want it, you have to say yes. Because, of course, in Britain, if you say yes when someone offers you something like a cup of tea, you're told you have to say no a couple of times before you say yes. And so if you do that in America, it's not going to go very well. So I remember all of that. It's one thing I remember. Anyway, I decided to go up to Boston. So I got on a train and went to Boston and was lucky enough to get a job selling duty-free at the airport. And ironically, selling it in what's now Terminal C, an out terminal. Back then, of course, JetBlue hadn't even been created or even thought of. So it does. I love going back to our folks at Terminal C in Boston because it does remind me of how I got into this whole crazy business in the first place.
Well, that's wonderful. And I think that, you know, converting someone from the UK or Great Britain to Boston, I think that it's letting people know what you want is important, knowing that which teams to root for, the difference between cricket and baseball, that the trainers are called sneakers here. But other than that, I think we're in good shape. And I should have mentioned this at the onset for our attendees. At around 12:30, we will open it up for member questions. Please post your questions in the Q&A section of the chat. We will come to you in turn. At around 1 o'clock, we will go to the lightning round where we'll bring Wick back in, and Robin, Wick, and I will have a conversation, and we'll end after their message of hope promptly at 1:15, as we always do. But Robin, turning a little bit now to the current situation in the pandemic, before I get to strategy of JetBlue. Obviously, this pandemic has changed how JetBlue operates over the past 6 months. How have you worked to sort of ensure the health and safety of both your employees, but also the customers who are fearful of travel and getting on an airplane?
Yeah, no, thanks, Juan. I appreciate the question. I mean, I remember, you know, maybe just go back to March, because I think this thing crept up on everybody. And, you know, I remember being, we were down in Washington in very early March, starting to talk to Congress about a relief bill for airlines, because we'd started to see some very quick deterioration. I mean, in the space of a couple of weeks, we went from about 2.5 to 2.7 million people flying through the US airline system down to less than a third of that, literally in a couple of weeks. And the cash that was going out the door, I mean, I never thought we'd be in a situation of having negative revenue we were refunding more every day than we were taking in. So that was going on. And right here in New York, of course, which New York, as you know, really was the place that got hit quick and hard, things were moving very quickly. And just thinking back to that time and how the most important priority of all was to keep our people safe. And yet not having all the information that we needed to do that. And I mean, you go back to April and May, we were down to 3 or 4% of our people, of customers flying. So, you know, we moved quickly to put sort of health programs in place to say to people, please don't come to work if you're feeling sick, you know, changing our sick policies so that people weren't financially disadvantaged and felt they had to come into work. We obviously ramped up the cleaning and sterilization and of our airplanes very quickly. I remember back then a lot of our crew members say, well, what about masks? Now, it's all we talk about, and it's a proven mitigant to the spread of coronavirus. But of course, back then the CDC advice was no masks. In fact, masks don't help. So you're dealing with a lot of those issues that are coming up at the same time. And our people were just magnificent, and they came to work every day. And then we started flying healthcare workers into New York because the New York system, hotel health system, was overwhelmed. And the biggest issue was the lack of trained people, particularly nurses. And we were literally sending airplanes to Albuquerque to pick up 6 people, all medical workers, to bring them back. And our crew members felt a huge sense of duty around that, and felt that's what we could do to help get through this. And so safety was a focus early, and I think over the course of time we've been able to improve that as guidance has changed. So now we're keeping middle seats free, you know, we've got face coverings which are mandatory, some of the cleaning procedures have stayed in place, really to try to give people's confidence, both our crew members now, customers, confidence that flying is as safe as anything else that you would do. You're on mute, Juan.
Perfect. One of the things that's struck me over the past several months has been this incredible effort by so many organizations and corporations that have come together and have done collectively efforts, like you were mentioning, in terms of flying nurses around. And you're seeing that in just about every space. So I think that's really heartening as so many of us are going through and facing, you know, what we find challenging times and so many people dealing with depression and everything else. So I am really pleased to hear that from so many. How have things changed here in the fall? I mean, everyone had sort of hoped that the fall would come and schools would start and travel would open up. How have things sort of, have you seen a shift for the past several months? Are more people getting your airplanes? You had mentioned earlier a little bit that those who do are feeling more comfortable, but can you tell us a little bit about what's happening sort of now and what you expect in the very near future?
Sure. So, right back at the beginning, during the height of the pandemic, we were flying about 3 to 4% of what we would normally fly. Right now, as I sit here today and we're looking at September, October, that's closer to 30 to 35%. So look, we're still significantly down on last year, but we have continued to see this improvement. And what we're finding is that at the beginning, we kind of did a load of scenarios, I think like a load of companies, in terms of how quick do we think the recovery is going to be. And we kind of settled on the L-shaped recovery, which is a slow but steady climb out. So far, we're tracking on that. You know, it is a little bit non-linear in terms of it kind of has a rush for 2 weeks and then something happens and people cancel and then they come back. But we're seeing that slow and steady climb out of it. We're seeing leisure, visiting friends and family. So, you know, places like Puerto Rico, you know, we're back to nearly probably close to half of what we'd normally be flying. And then other markets like New York, they've really barely recovered. And so we do see quite a big spread. So leisure, visiting friends and family is recovering. Business travel, I mean, our business travel is probably 2 to 3% of what we'd normally see. So I think that just shows you that business travel remains extremely impacted by the coronavirus.
And how have you maintained the morale of the workforce, the people who are getting on the planes and welcoming these people with masks or at one point without masks? How is
How has that been from your employee satisfaction and safety?
Well, I think the most important thing is making sure our people feel that we are committed to their safety and security. And so a lot of what we put in place, we talked about some of the policies earlier, and there's been others we put in place more recently. And the second thing is we came into this and we said, you know, the thing that our people, most important to people is protecting their job. And so we've been very lucky with the CARES Act that has allowed us an ability to protect everyone's job. And we're still working hard to do that. So, you know, even though the CARES Act, which is due to run out the end of September, you know, we're pushing hard for an extension. But even if we don't get that, you know, we are said to our crew members, we continue to do everything we can to keep them in jobs and avoid furloughs. And so I think a mixture of safety and security, a mixture of them knowing that we are doing everything we can as an organization to protect their jobs. You know, I think that's what our people need most right now. And you know, we've also done a lot of virtual town hall meetings. So every week we will do a virtual town hall meeting, a bit like this. Mm-hmm. We've done 31 of these now, and we get thousands of people. I don't know whether we should use the word Zoom in or call in, whatever. We don't use Zoom, so I probably shouldn't say Zoom. But you know, people will call in and can ask questions, because I think it's the concern around things that they don't know. My last point is we've also been very aggressive at trying new things. So believe it or not, we've announced 57 new routes during this pandemic. And so our crew members look at that and they see us really trying and being creative to create demand and protect their jobs and help JetBlue kind of dig out of this.
Yeah, and I want to get to those new routes at some point as well. And I know one of the places that you had proposed and sort of really interesting is London, mm-hmm. right? And while many are pairing and cutting routes from airlines, you guys are being aggressive in opening up new routes. That seems to be part of the strategy for you to continue to expand and generate profit.
Yeah, so London, you know, I think, as I said earlier, we about 20% of what we fly today is business travel. 80% is leisure. And we're looking at business travel and we say, look, that's not going to come back anytime soon. So how do we take those assets and that capacity and redeploy into leisure markets, visiting friends and family markets? So a lot of what we've been doing is that. So, you know, only last week we announced, this week, we announced 4 new routes out of Hartford, Connecticut. London was something actually we had planned before the pandemic, and Boston, London specifically is something we had planned before the pandemic. And the rationale for that is we see the very high fares that get charged for people to fly between Boston and London. In fact, quite often it's higher, it's more expensive to fly in business class from Boston to London than New York to London. And we look at what we did on the Transcon with our Mint product out of, say, Boston to LA and San Francisco, where we came on and I think improved the quality of the service and slashed the fare. And we say, you know, we have an opportunity to do that to London too. And so that's what we're focused on, and we're on track to launch that in Q3 next year and bring a very high quality product at a fare that I can't say what the fare is going to be, because that would be illegal signaling, but at a fare significantly lower than anyone's ever dreamed of paying today for a business class seat to London.
That's fantastic. I know that my wife, who's a Mosaic member, has already highlighted London in 2021 as one of those places that we're looking forward to traveling.
That's great. You know, that's great. Love it.
Safety allowing. Turning back to your employees, I watched an interview with you recently where you talked about the role of a CEO at JetBlue, and you appreciated and found so special about JetBlue specifically was the culture. What is it about the culture that you try to instill, and why is it so important to your organization?
Well, you know, when you join JetBlue on the first day, certainly before this all happened, you go to Orlando for what we call orientation. And as all of our senior leaders go down, I go down, other senior leaders go down. And that's our first day with our new employees. We call them crew members. And the first thing we say is there's only really two types of employees or crew members at JetBlue. There's those that serve the customers and those that serve the customers. And so for me, which I'm in a support role, you know, our job is to be there to support our crew members, to remove obstacles that get in their way in terms of providing service to our customers and solve some of the concerns and issues that they have. And so that's how we approach it. We spend a huge amount of time out in the operation. Even though we've been in this pandemic, you know, we are out visiting our crew members. Obviously, it's harder, right? Because we're trying to maintain distancing. We can't have these big in-person town hall meetings that we mm-hmm. normally like to do. But it's very important that our people know that we're there and that everyone is pulling in the same direction to try and get JetBlue through this. In normal times, you know, in addition to spending time down on their first day, you know, we do a lot of town hall meetings. Leaders clean the airplanes with our crew members when they return them. We just do a lot together so that everyone knows that we're, you know, in the same boat and we're all trying to head in the same direction.
And one of the things that strikes me every time I fly JetBlue, which is almost all the time I'm on an airplane, and I suspect it comes from culture, is everyone seems to be happy, right? The crew members seem to be happy. And I know that's part of their job, but I think that they're a little bit more informal and it seems they're having fun and they try to pass it on to the passengers. Again, they do it in the appropriate protocols and safety and all that sort of stuff. But I'm always pleased when the pilots or the attendants are on the microphone. Mm-hmm. And I always feel like, you know, we're going from Boston to New Orleans today and we're going to make it safe, but we're going to have as much fun as we can in that journey. And I think that's got to come from the culture of JetBlue and from the top.
Yeah, you know, I think our people are magnificent. We try to hire the right people as well. I mean, I often have this joke orientation that it's harder to get into JetBlue than Harvard, which actually it is based on the numbers, although I'm not obviously making a direct comparison. But, you know, we're very lucky that we can be very selective on who we hire, and that's very important. And then when people are here, it's making sure that people feel part of the team, that they feel empowered to do what they need to do to take care of customers, and they're empowered when things go wrong to solve things for customers. And we know we're not perfect, and we know that there are things that we do that are sometimes outside of our control. You know, it's funny with the pandemic, we spent all summer looking at the air traffic control delays, and we haven't had one this year. But, you know, we have amazing people, and I think the fact that we've not furloughed anyone in 21 years of history, despite some very challenging times, I think, again, speaks to the fact that we're in this together. We're going to fight through this pandemic together. We're going to get to the other side as one team.
I think that's fantastic and to some extent amazing that there hasn't been a single furlough for your company's history over time, especially during what's been happening. And in terms of the joy or the communication on the flights, I just know that, you know, as a traveler, things are outside of the pilot's control, right? There's weather, there's all sorts of stuff that's going on. But I always find that JetBlue tells us as much as they can and they communicate. So when I'm sitting in that seat and things aren't going the way I expect, I'm told, here's what's happening and we're doing the best we can. And I think that constant communication has been, just again, as a customer of JetBlue's, I appreciate it. I'm going to turn quickly over to sustainability. JetBlue has made a serious commitment to sustainability. And as a result, you've achieved carbon neutrality on domestic flights. This comes with a cost, obviously, but why is it so important to JetBlue?
Well, I think, it's very important the airline industry recognizes the role that we play in impacting climate change. And a few years ago, the whole industry came together to pass an international treaty that was basically committed to reducing global carbon emissions by 50% by 2050. And I think, you know, you go back a few years, we were all patting ourselves on the back and saying, wow, to get almost every country in the world to agree to that, isn't that amazing? And it was. But the reality is that this issue is moving much more quickly than any of us thought. And 50% by 2050 isn't enough. And so for us to, if we want to keep aviation accessible, if we want to keep fares low, so our kids and their kids have the ability of affordable air travel in the same way that I did and you did, then the industry has to be able to grow, but also has to be able to offer an answer to the question around sustainability. And so we decided JetBlue to take a leadership role in that. There's a number of things that we're doing, whether it's investing in our new airplanes. So we have a lot of new A220s coming to Boston to replace our 190s. We've got next generation 321s that we are rolling out. Whether it's our sort of commitment and energy around more efficient air traffic control procedures, or whether it's investments in sustainable aviation fuel. So we are now, our flights out of San Francisco, we are loading up with sustainable aviation fuel. All of those things together will have an impact over time. But of course, it takes time for those things to truly improve our carbon footprint. So what we're doing in addition to that is making sure we're offsetting all of our domestic carbon emissions through reputable audited offset programs. But we fully recognize that these offset programs are really a bridge to us be able to self-help and make sure that we make that commitment to carbon neutrality in our own right. It's just going to take time because the sustainable aviation fuel industry is still very immature and it's not yet scaling up to the degree that we need it to.
Well, hopefully some of the other airlines will follow your lead. And I think the more commitment we can get to the net neutrality on sustainability will be fantastic and much needed. I'm going to ask one more question, but then we are going to open it up to our audience for Q&A. And the first question is going to come from Lisa Weiland, the CEO of Massport Authority. We've decided to give her the first question, but my last question is, as Lisa gets ready and we'll have our team unmute her in a second, has to do with sort of diversity and inclusion. And inclusion, certainly it's something that's become even more visible in the past several months. And recent examples of racial injustice have caused society to consider what can be done. What is JetBlue doing in this regard in contributing to making racial equality more of the fabric of everyday life and what we're doing?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And, I think when we look at all the challenging circumstances that all organizations have faced in 2020, we're going through a pandemic, which, and there's a lot written about how the communities most impacted by the pandemic are quite often communities of color. And then you think about the horrific events that we all saw in Minneapolis. And, it really was a rallying cry for all of us. And, at JetBlue, we have a very diverse workforce in terms of our frontline leaders and even our supervisors. But where we have not done anything like as good enough job is diversity in our higher paying jobs, whether those are leaderships or pilots. I mean, the airline industry is actually blessed to have a number of higher paying jobs, whether those leadership roles, whether they're pilots, whether they're sort of maintenance technicians. And so we've really used it as a rallying cry internally to set some very clear goals and direction to ensure that we make progress over the next few years in ensuring that our leadership and our higher paying jobs are enjoyed by all of our people. And I'll give you an example. To be a pilot, is still largely male. It's about 95% male, 5% female, and people of color also significantly underrepresented. And yet we know, notwithstanding what we're going through at the moment, this country is going to need tens, if not hundreds of thousands of new pilots over the next 15, 20 years. So let's change that now. And I think there are things that we can do to make the career as a pilot much more accessible to people in different communities much more quickly. And I think we can have an impact over the next few years. And so we're committed to it as a board, as a leadership team. We're setting out some pretty demanding targets and the whole of the organization is rallying around that to make sure we get it done.
Well, I'll look forward to seeing that when I'm on planes in the future and moving forward for JetBlue. But I think that's great. Obviously, wish more, everyone would do more and I wish everyone had done more earlier, but the fact that we're having these conversations, I think heartens many of us that many are heading in the right direction. So that's good. I am now going to, with luck, with technology and everything else, we are going to unmute Lisa Weiland from the Massport Authority and let Lisa have our first question. So Lisa, are you there and able to join us?
I am. Can you hear me, Warren?
We can. Welcome.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. Robin, so nice to see you. Thank you to you and your entire team at JetBlue for being terrific business partners. I think together we've accomplished quite a lot over the years and look forward to the years to come. I thought it might be interesting to have you talk about your new strategic partnership with American Airlines, a little bit about the rationale for the partnership, its impact in particular on the Northeast, and perhaps how the post-security connections we're currently building at Logan Airport between Terminal C and B will help facilitate your new partnership.
Great. Thanks, Lisa. So great to hear from you as well. And just right back at you, just know how much we appreciate the team at Massport. You know, in fact, I end up doing events all around the world. And, you know, there's always people looking to pitch airports and airlines against each other. And I always give the examples of the relationship JetBlue has with Massport as the best one. And just a bit of a story, which I'm not sure Lisa's even aware of, but way back in the fall of 2008, when we had made a decision that we wanted to grow Boston in a major way, I remember flying up to Boston and meet with Ed Frenney, who works for Lisa. Ed runs the sort of aviation part of Massport. And I said to Ed, you know, Ed, we want to grow this place 150 flights. And he's, you know, Ed's been around the industry a long time. He doesn't, he sees, you know, he sees when people are not being direct with him pretty easily. And he said, you're kidding me. I said, no, Ed, that's what we want to do. And we spent time with him. And there's a bunch of things that Ed said he would go and do in 2008. And he's done every single one of them. But that's really what's facilitated our growth. So just huge gratitude to you, Lisa and Ed and all of the team at Massport. You're just simply terrific. And by the way, Massport, just for everyone on the call, Massport do this unique meeting every morning, 7 days a week, where they get together with all of the airlines, all of the agencies. I think no one else does that like Massport does. And it's came after 9/11 and how everyone has to get more on the same page with this stuff. And again, unique, and just thank you for the partnership. But back to your question about American Airlines. For those who may not be aware, what we announced a little bit ago was a strategic partnership in the Northeast between JetBlue and American. And what that is really aimed to do is to kind of allow customers to connect between JetBlue and American in a way that they can't do today. So, you know, when we think about New York and Boston, what that's going to allow JetBlue to do is grow in a fairly significant way. It's also going to allow American to grow by adding more long-haul flights to international destinations that we can feed. And the idea is to create seamless experience for our customers, both in, you know, the ability to buy through tickets, through check-in, obviously to change flights. But also, you know, and then working with each other's frequent flyer programs to allow people to sort of earn and burn miles on each other. So we're very excited. It's a partnership that's very focused on the Northeast. So we'll still be competing with American out of South Florida. We'll still be competing with American on our new flights from Boston to London. But on everyone else, the idea is that we're going to create connecting itineraries and you know, I think Massport's always so far ahead. I sometimes think Massport know all this stuff's going to happen before we even thought of it, because they've been working on this connector program for several years now, and that's going to really, I think, enable the customer experience and allow both JetBlue and American to sell more over and through Boston.
Thank you, Lisa, for that question and for all the work that Massport is doing to keep the travelers safe. We look forward to speaking with you further about this in the future. And Robin, you've got a commitment to Boston. You've spent time in Boston. JetBlue is partnering in Boston. You have a lot of love for Massport here. Any chance that the headquarters would find their way up north a little bit? I mean, we're always competing with New York.
Well, yeah. You know, it's funny because it only seemed yesterday we did a whole process around whether we were going to stay in New York or not. And actually, in I think next year we have to start thinking about that again. So we all spend so much time in Boston. I sometimes feel that our head office is in Boston. But no plans right now to move what we call our support center, what you've said is head office out of New York. We continue to grow jobs, not just in Boston, but also our commitment to Worcester as well.
Yeah.
We're going to continue to grow and create more jobs in Boston.
Well, we'll certainly keep us in mind. And I know that many of the attendees and our members would be happy to help you on that strategy of shifting to Boston.
We'll be in touch next year.
Excellent. Excellent. You give us the date and we'll bring you back. Yeah. You can make your announcement on our stage. We'd love to do that. Our next question is going to come from Andrew Burton of Rapid 7. So I'm going to unmute him. But before we do that, we also had a comment from Liz Bruner, who's on the board here at Make-A-Wish in Boston. And she wanted to just thank you personally and JetBlue for your commitment to that charitable organization. So again, on behalf of Liz and Make-A-Wish, thank you for your commitment. So with any luck, Andrew from Rapid 7, you should be joining us.
Hey, Robin, and thank you, Warren. I appreciate it. Robin, thanks for taking my question. I am a Mosaic member, and I've been a longtime fan of JetBlue, based here in Boston. I'm curious. I was actually one day I was sitting down in New York trying to get back to Boston, and my JetBlue flight was delayed. And I'd looked online, and from what I could see at the time, JetBlue has, because it operates primarily in the Northeast, has one of the highest flight delays in the industry, but yet has incredible customer satisfaction and customer sentiment. So I'm curious, how do you think about being able to achieve such incredible customer results operating in an environment that is inherently very challenging for you?
Well, the good news is, Andrew, there's no delays anymore. We got rid of all of those. It's funny. Like I, every flight I've done recently is left early and got there early. I'm like, I'm quite enjoying this. But, I think that it's a great question. A couple of years ago, there was a real push for ATC reform. Because if you look at the air traffic control system in the U.S., it is based on very old technology, and the process of change is quite slow. And so what we've seen every year is the congested airspace just get harder and harder. And for an airline like JetBlue in the US, about 70% of our flying is in congested airspace. So about 70% of our flying is subject to regular delays. And that's much higher than any other percentage of any other US airline has. I think United Airlines is the next most congested, and that's about 50% because they've obviously got San Francisco, Chicago, and Newark. And so that is a challenge. And, I think what we focus on is, though, what are some of the things we can do to mitigate that for people when it happens? And, Juan, you touched on this earlier, but regular communication is important to people, so people understand why that is. People don't want to be lied to. Sometimes I think we can be too honest, because then I get complaints saying I didn't really want to know that part of the engine needed to be replaced. But we try and get our people to sort of be transparent. And so we also know that our customer satisfaction scores do go up when we're on time. And, I think we continue to do a lot of work to improve our on-time performance, but also work to try to mitigate some of these longer air traffic control delays that are very frustrating. And, for those of you who fly, for example, out of LaGuardia from LaGuardia to Boston or DCA to Boston, and you come on, it's like, our wheels up time is in 50 minutes and it's only a 30 minute flight. Those things are really frustrating for people. Once we get through this pandemic and things start to get back to normal, I think we have to revisit this issue of air traffic control reform so we can recreate more capacity and efficiency in the system.
Great, that's a good question. Thanks for joining us. I'm gonna turn to Randy Seidel of Revenue Acceleration. Randy, good to see or hear from you again today. You're up.
Hey, thanks, Robin. Love JetBlue. Great to have you flying out of Boston so much. I just have to fly to more cities. One suggestion is, I think there's a big niche to fly to Eagle Vale. Nobody else flies nonstop, so I'll put in the plug for that selfishly.
Noted.
And then also with Mosaic, given the COVID situation, do you anticipate grandfathering Mosaic members for next year?
I think we may have already have done that.
Great.
But I will have someone check that before the end of this this event, but I think we've done that. But I will check. Randy, thanks for being a mosaic, and thanks for flying us. And look, I think, again, one of the things that we're excited about the partnership with American is it's going to open up new destinations. And there are a number of routes that are sort of marginal at the moment, but I think with some of the additional demand that can be created with the partnership with American, we can get on our network. And so, we're going to continue to build the breadth of destinations out of Boston over the coming years. You've got our complete commitment to do that.
Great, thanks.
Thanks, wonderful. Warren. Thanks, Randy, and thanks for asking the mosaic question so I don't have to for my wife, but I do believe what Robin is telling is something that my wife was happy to hear. So again, good question. Next up is Quincy Miller from Eastern Bank. Quincy, been a while, but happy to have you joining us, and the microphone is all yours with any luck.
Okay, great. Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes, Quincy.
Perfect, thanks. So another mosaic client here.
Wow, okay.
And it did get extended, I know. I was on top of that one.
Okay, good.
But my question is, you've talked a lot about the impact of COVID, and I think I have more of a future-looking question for you, which is, what do you see as the long-term impact of COVID? I mean, for example, one of the things we've seen is some of the airlines actually waive change fees permanently, eliminate those. At least it sounds like that's what they've done. And I know that's always been one of the great perks of Mosaic. So I'm just interested in, your future thoughts. Once there is a vaccine, as we look forward, will there be things and, will the business operate differently?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I think, one of the things that we're trying to pick through is what do we think is going to last and stay, and what do we think is temporary? And I think things like, I mean, it's interesting. I was saying to Juan before we went live that we're getting our highest ever customer satisfaction scores now. And a lot of that relates to just the cleanliness and the hygiene of the airplanes. I think that's going to stay. I think the old days of getting on a flight and there's a few crumbs on the floor, I mean, I think those days are thankfully gone. And so I think we're going to be better at that. And I completely agree with you about the change fees. I mean, we were actually the first airline to, when we went into COVID, to waive change fees. I remember doing a CNBC article in April, right here in this building in New York, talking about how I think change fees are going to go, because I think that it's going to be very hard to force airlines to, make people fly if they're not well. So we've actually continued to roll all of our change fees through to the end of February. So anyone that's not booking a trip, that's any flight that you book on the internet or with us or travel agent by February 28th for any time into next year, no change fees. And then what you saw some other airlines announce a month ago was like change fees going. It's actually though not what they, it's what people read into it. What they actually said was that they are going to reintroduce no changes and cancellations to their basic economy fare. So what they've said is, if you buy one of their lower fares, they will, you from the 1st of January, you won't be able to change or cancel those. If you buy one of their regular fares, that's where you can change them. So our view about what they've done is reintroduce cancellation penalties for over half their fares. We don't think that's appropriate in the current environment. And, I think as we continue into next year, I think, change fees are something that are going to be much less common. And then back to your question about the mosaic, this is a really good question. One of the big benefits of being a mosaic was there were no change fees. Suddenly that benefit is more widely available. So, we're giving some thought to that now about how we maintain that value proposition for mosaic when the rules of the game have changed around change fees. So hopefully that answers your question, Quincy, as best I can today.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Apparently our members are huge JetBlue fans, because a lot of the questions you're getting are mosaic and roots and everything else. So I'm going to turn.
Juan, just a sec. Can you go and see if Don is in the building and bring him here? Thank you. I'm going to go and introduce you to someone in a minute who runs the Mosaic program, and then everyone can see him and can ask him any questions at any time in the future. So
yeah, we'll do that in a minute. If you could just give us his cell number, that would be great, so that every time we're heading to Logan, we could give him a quick call to make sure we're in good shape.
Give you his home number, his home address, his cell. We'll give you everything. Everything.
Fantastic.
No secrets.
It's all about customer service. Yep. Our next question is going to come from Diane Darling, but before we turn to her, I've received a question from one of our members who couldn't join us but wanted me to ask the question, and I'm sure she'll watch this on YouTube later. Joanne Simons from Northeast Arc, our CEO at Northeast Arc, says, for those of us who fly commercial, we love JetBlue. When booking, will we be able to see whether a middle seat has been blocked, and if so, for how long would the safety measure be in place?
Yeah, a great question. So right now we are blocking the middle seats through till the 15th of October, which is obviously a few weeks away. We're going to kind of announce in the next day or two what we plan to do after the 15th of October. But rest assured, we're going to continue to put significant caps on our flight so that there's plenty of room to spread out. One of the things, you know, is just one of the things that we got to get better at is when groups are traveling together, right? So if they're your family of four or five, you're traveling, you don't necessarily want to be split over three sets of seats. And so we're just figuring, but then people get on the airplane and they see people there, so, well, the middle seats aren't free. Well, they are, but they're traveling together, but you don't necessarily know that. So we're just trying to work through how we phrase it, how we say it, but we are going to continue with blocking our flights, at least for the foreseeable future, to give people a sense of space and distance on board.
That's great. I know that's so important to many of us as we contemplate that first trip on an airplane or continued travel. And you mentioned group sales. I should mention, for the past 8 years, I have led a group of about 20 Boston College undergraduate students for a service trip down to New Orleans. JetBlue flies direct from Boston to New Orleans and also partnered with the World War II Museum down there. And so mm-hmm. we have been consistent JetBlue travelers.
Right.
And that partnership between JetBlue and the city of New Orleans and the World War II Museum has been fantastic. And so I thank you on behalf of our students going down there to do some good community service, rebuilding houses post-Katrina for that. Diane Darling, with luck, we can unmute you and give you the microphone.
I think it's Diane Durkin, not Diane Darling.
Sorry, Diane.
Okay. All right. So I'm also Mosaic. Love you. And I heard you on Squawk Box this morning.
Oh.
So could you highlight in a little bit more detail what you think the industry needs after the CARE Act, which mm-hmm. is disappearing shortly, what you think the industry is going to need in order to survive, because obviously we've got a longer time period going here before people are really feeling comfortable traveling.
Yeah, thanks, Diane. And just a bit of historical background for everyone who may not be aware. What happened in the original CARES bill was there was a $25 billion provision for the airline industry in the form of a grant, of which 70% of it does not need to be paid back. 30% of it does need to be paid back. And that was to really pay people to stay working for the airlines. And the alternative back in April and May, back in March or April, if we hadn't have had that, the reality is probably most airlines would have furloughed 80 to 90% of their workforce. And if you look at what then would be paid in federal unemployment benefit, state unemployment benefit, the taxes that would be lost to the Treasury, it was actually a very cost-effective solution to put the CARES Act in place that allowed airlines to keep people in jobs. And as a condition of that, then we had to commit to keeping everyone in jobs, which was done. Back to Diane's point, that is due to run out on the 30th of September. So we are working as an airline community and as with our labor partners on trying to persuade Congress to extend it. I was down in DC this week with some of my colleagues and labor leaders, and we have very good bipartisan support. And the proposal is a clean extension. So the same deal going forward for another 6 months that would, in exchange, all the same commitments are in place about not furloughing everyone. And the concern is if this isn't done by next September, then airlines are going to have to furlough potentially up to 100,000 people. And it's not just the people that go, it's the airplanes that get parked. And what we've seen from previous types of shocks like this back in 01 and 08, which, you know, were nothing like this, we saw a lot of service loss to medium and smaller communities. So, you know, airports like Boston are just fine. Airports like New York will just be fine. But then you've got all these secondary airports where they'll lose service very quickly. And once they've lost service, it can take years to get them back. And so, you know, our argument is let's keep the industry together. We think post-vaccine, the industry, the travel hospitality sector can recover very quickly. And this offers great value for money for the government as well, because they're going to pay the same. And if people are furloughed, they lose healthcare. Healthcare costs are burdened on states. They lose access to pensions. If we keep them on our payroll, you know, the employers continue to meet all those obligations. So that's what we're working on. And we have a week to get it done. We have good bipartisan support. What we're struggling with at the moment is there's no vehicle for it, because it really should be part of a broader bipartisan CARES 2 or CARES 3 bill, depending on how you count that. And as you know, there isn't alignment on that yet. There are some standalone bills that are in the House and the Senate on this. And there is the possibility of executive action by the White House, who are supportive of doing something. But neither of those things, I think, was effective as a bipartisan bill. So that's JetBlue's preference, and that's the industry's preference. And I am going to introduce you to Donny. Donny, what we're doing here is the Boston College Chief Executive Club, and we have all these amazing CEOs. They're all Mosaic members. And I just wanted to introduce you, because you are Mr. Mosaic. So come over here, Donny. We're going to socially distance, and I'm just going to slide Donny in. This is Donny, everybody.
Hey, good afternoon.
Donny runs our loyalty program, Mosaic program, and he's here for you. He's very responsive to our customers, and we'll be happy to help at any time. Right, Donny?
Absolutely.
These are all your Mosaics. So they all want to know how you're going to keep the program valuable when the change fees are free for everybody, because they love the no changes. But of course, they're going to be able to get that. And I have explained that's a bit of a trickery, because half the fares on other airlines are still going to have change fees.
Correct.
But you're working on making Mosaic bigger and better, aren't you?
Absolutely. We're actually, no one hopes for a pandemic, but we're actually looking at this as an opportunity. As we come out and through the recovery, how can we continue to innovate and really make Mosaic even better? So thank you for all of our Mosaics out there.
Robin, thank you for the introduction. And Donny, thank you for joining us. I've been pleased with how many people are Mosaic members and have questions. And Robin promised your home and cell numbers for everybody. So expect the phones to light up this evening.
Yes, we'll definitely do that.
Yeah, outstanding. Next up is going to be John Morris from Crestwood Advisors. And just that we know that Jim will be next. Jim Roosevelt is on deck. But John, hopefully you're here with us now. And I think you are hiding under Robert Ick. So if the team is trying to unmute you.
We call that Zoom lurking. Lurking is someone else's
name. He wants credit for a good question, but if we
can
don't
hear me now?
Question, yes, we can. Thanks for joining
perfect.
Us,
John. Yeah. Sorry, I co-opted it, even though I'm a BC CEO member. Thanks, Warren. Robin, thanks for being a part of today's interesting conversation. I have a two-pronged question. One, how does JetBlue consider going to a destination market like Bozeman, Montana, which you now offer direct service? And I'm going to jump on Randy Seidel's earlier comment about Eagle Vale, but because of the changes in work habits because of the pandemic, people aren't necessarily working in urban settings any longer, but often in more destination locations, leisure destination locations, consider Florida or the West or other parts of the country. Does that affect some of JetBlue's thinking about adding routes or in maybe a more limited way, direct flights out of Boston to some, you know, places like Jackson Hole, or maybe it's Albuquerque, New Mexico? Give us some thoughts, at least on that first and second question, if you could. Thank you.
Yeah, no, it's a really, really good point. And you're absolutely right. And I'll be the first to say to you that we don't really have a handle yet on how things are going to change in terms of, you know, how people are going to think about destinations. I mean, I will tell you, September is normally a lousy month for leisure, but we have got people flying that never normally fly in September. So we know there's an interest in sort of more outdoor vacations. So we try to tap into that. You know, as I said earlier, we've announced 54 new routes this year, and maybe 57 now. Many of those are we're trying things because we think that there's a strong preference for direct flights as well. You know, I think for people who are flying, we see a strong preference for direct flights versus connecting. And I think it's unbelievable what's going on. I was going down to DC on Tuesday, and I'm looking at the flights for another airline, and there's like two flights a day between DCA and LaGuardia. Right? I mean, we're used to having a flight every 30 to 60 minutes. So it's crazy what's going on at the moment. So I think direct flights, more direct flights from Boston and our other sort of major focus cities, you're definitely going to see more of that. I'd love to do Jackson Hole, but unfortunately we need we don't have the right airplane for that from Boston. It actually needs to be a Airbus 319 or a Boeing 320. Can't get in there. But you know, I think you're absolutely right. Trying things like Bozeman and other destinations that you've mentioned and others that we're thinking about, I think you're going to see more and more of that. The other good news at the moment is we have airplanes to spare, which we don't normally have. And so we can actually do some of these flights as daylight flights instead of the dreaded red eyes, which is very efficient from an aircraft utilization point of view, but isn't always popular with travelers. Warren, you're on mute again.
Sorry, they've decided to do some leaf blowing outside our office, and then there was a car alarm, so I apologize. But you're an old hat at these meetings, so thanks for letting me know. Sometimes I go for a while. We have time for two more questions before we bring Wick back into our lightning round. First, I'm going to turn to Jim Roosevelt from Verrill Dana, and then John Speck from Coaching for Change. We'll get our last question. But Jim, hopefully you're there, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Warren, and glad you're able to put these virtual meetings together. And Robin, thank you for this very informative presentation. Our family are big JetBlue fans, and consequently, because of flights I had to cancel in March, I'm heavily invested in your travel bank at the moment and looking forward to being able to spend that money. I wanted to mention that some of our extended family who live out in the San Francisco Bay Area, when they found that for weeks they couldn't go outside their house and could barely breathe inside their house, the fact that they could get on JetBlue with a middle seat blocked led them to come here to ride out the smoke and fires on Martha's Vineyard. So it had a direct effect on their making that decision, and we're very happy they were able to do that. One really local question is, I think you may have had to suspend service to Worcester in this situation, and what do you think are the longer term prospects for that?
No, it's a temporary suspension. You know, I think just the challenge we had with a market like, for example, Boston, Orlando, where we may have flown four or five a day, you know, you go down to maybe one or two a day and you can carry the demand. On a market like Worcester, say to Orlando, you know, there was just so little demand, it wasn't really effective to cost effective to continue to do it. But we will be back to Worcester, and if we didn't come back to Worcester, I think Ed Frenney would track me down and make sure we were back pretty quickly. So, and given that everyone at JetBlue is scared of Ed, I think you can safely assume that we'll be back to Worcester.
Thanks, Robin.
Wonderful. We're looking to that route opening up. As I indicated, we have our last question from John Speck, Coaching for Change, and then we'll bring Wick back in for our lightning round of questions with Robin. But John, hopefully you're there with us. John, are you there? No? Let me see. I think I have his question here if he's not able to join us. He asked about, he saw that you're adding 24 new routes or so, and he was hoping to get a feel for how many employees that would mean that you would be bringing back onto the JetBlue team, or new employees.
Yeah, it's really not so much about new employees at the moment. It's really, you know, we have a very large surplus of people because our flight activity is about 45% of what it would normally be. So I think the idea of these extra flights are really allowing us to just put our current people to work and obviously to protect jobs over the long term. And the CARES Act gives requires airlines to keep people through to the end of September. But from the 1st of October, those restrictions go. And so, as I was mentioning earlier, rather than furloughing, we're keen to take advantage of the opportunities that the pandemic brings, add new flights. I mean, of the 57 new flights we've added this summer, not all of those were going to work. Some will, many will. But you know, we got to try these things. Yeah, we're talking earlier about Boston Bozeman. We got to find those opportunities that perhaps we wouldn't have ever got to in the normal time, and try and make them work.
Wonderful. We're looking forward to more routes, certainly from here in Boston, but for JetBlue's expansion. Wick, I think we're going to be able to unmute you and bring your video back on. So let's see if we can do that. There we go. As we get ready for the lightning round of questions.
This is scary, the lightning round.
You better be ready, because I know Wick is. I've seen him in the last second offense, and he's good at this. I've got a simple question, but one that several of our members have asked me to ask. So I'm going to start off with really quick, really important question. Aisle or window?
Oh, window, because I've got to get up and help work the flight.
Wick?
You want to know, I'm window all the way. I like having my space. I like being able to look out, and then I can sleep against it. It's a trifecta.
Excellent. Excellent. I know these are the dying questions. So one of the things that I find fascinating as I go through this with CEOs is finding out what your first paying job was, and how that sort of set you up on this trajectory. So Robin, what was your first paying job?
I was a paper boy at the age of 11, earning £1 a week, delivering newspapers 7 days a week. So I earned about 14 pence a day. It was about a 45-minute round, so my hourly pay was about 20 pence.
That's outstanding. I've been amazed as I ask these questions. I would say almost a third to a half of our CEOs started off as delivering papers on routes, whether it's bikes or walking. And clearly that ability to get up every morning early, regardless of the weather, and do that has some sort of impact on success. So
you also read a lot. Yeah.
Yes.
You're reading every paper.
Yeah. Wick, what was your first job?
I was a mover at New England Household Moving and Storage in Natick for $5 an hour when I was a senior in high school. And then after my freshman year in college as well, a little bit, or something like that. Anyway, two summers at $5 an hour. And there were more senior movers who would then direct me to take, you know, the washing machine down two stairs with like a strap and on my back and all this stuff. I mean, it was serious work. And I never knew that often the people would tip the movers because it didn't trickle down to me, but taught me that, you can get how to carry heavy things, I guess.
I think there's an inverse proportion to the size and weight of something being moved and the inability or lack of elevator to get there from what I've seen.
No, these were walk-ups. These were not elevator buildings.
Yeah. A more sort of fun question, I guess, is, Robin, what's the last song or album that you listened to? What was the last music that you intended to flip on and sort of create whatever environment you were after?
Well, I'm extremely boring about music, so I only really listen to one thing, which is Dire Straits.
Oh, Mark Knopfler. Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah. That's your consistent music?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's my go-to music. My kids do these playlists for me, but I'm a creature of habit, and I grew up with Dire Straits, and it's what I like to listen to. A bit of Elton John, you know. I mean, I sort of lucky enough to saw him here in Brooklyn, actually, there's a basketball team, I think, that plays there. They were great. So, So, look, I'm an 80s guy, right? I grew up with 80s music, and that's kind of what I'm all I listen to, really.
And I don't know, Robin, if you know this about Wick, but he's an accomplished drummer and a member of his own band. So other than your own band, Wick, what's the music that you'll listen to?
The accomplished part is the big question. Well, I'll tell you, music. It's interesting that you said music, because I brought my project for the bubble here is the bass. So that's my new bass guitar there, if I'm going to get
it. Oh, wow, look at that, yeah.
Yeah, if I'm going to get into the picture. And last night after the game, I came back and I played probably 45 minutes of Led Zeppelin, Tom Petty, and a little AC/DC. My first song I learned on the bass is Hell's Bells, because it's actually only three notes and it's a killer song. So, but it's a blast. So I've been listening to the classic British hard rock.
And I'm hoping that your room is adjacent or right above some of the players on the Miami Heat. So I'm hoping that tonight.
The amp does have some power. I brought the amp down with me, but I put it down at like one. I was just trying to be mellow.
I think tonight you could crank it to 11 as they did with Spinal Tap. So
turn it all the way up.
Big fan. Favorite guilty food, Robin?
Favorite guilty food?
Yeah. Guilty food.
Oh, look, all I eat is guilty food. You know, I got a sweet tooth, so I'm known to smuggle. Well, I shouldn't say smuggle, I suppose, to import some English candy or sweets, as we call them. Probably too much of that. And I don't go to McDonald's often, but every now and then it's nice to sneak in a Big Mac and just again remember your childhood.
Can we look for future British candy on the JetBlue flights in the future, and we can thank you for it?
Oh, more than you're ready to count or eat.
Excellent. Wick, what's your favorite guilty?
Well, I don't feel guilty because Amelia's fully Italian-American, but I get a lot of pasta, amazing pasta. And if I don't have two plates, she makes me feel guilty. So, I mean, there's just lots of carbs.
And as I mentioned food, I should mention Amelia and several of you, including yourself, Wick, has a tequila business out there. I don't know what JetBlue serves as tequila on their flights, but this seems like an opportune time to offer high-end tequila on those flights.
I think that's right.
We'd be glad to do a deal. Sapporo Tequila is actually, we're outselling Clase Azul in in three states at the moment, and we're only 10 months old. It's gotten a lot of great reception. So you ought to try it. If you imbibe, Robin, I'll be glad to send you a bottle.
Yeah, right. I would. I think I have to sample that before I can make any further commitment.
Okay, great.
Wonderful. Well, again, thanks for the lightning round. My last question is a little bit more serious in nature. And Wick, I will start with you. But as we've done these over the summer and fall now, we've had about 12 of these. And I stole this idea from Linda Henry in an interview I saw her do. I like to finish these on a positive note. And so I'm going to ask each of you to give us a message of hope, something that our members and all of us can take from today's session that gives us something to look forward to, that gives us something positive in today's world. It's so needed. And so I'd love to get briefly from each of you a message of hope. And Wick, I will start with you to see, in addition to a couple of more wins, what's your message of hope for all of us?
Appreciate that. Gosh, I've been trying to think about how 2020 would go down in history, what we can take out of this sort of disastrous year. And I think maybe it's the awakening towards the racial inequity and the systemic racism that we have here in the States, and how ignorant, I'll say I personally was of it, not willfully ignorant, but I think I was ignorant and complacent. And I didn't realize that, I'm just embarrassed to say, I didn't realize that there was so much to do. And now I've started to learn, and I'm trying to learn and trying to help do something about it. But 2020 is showing me that people do care. People are becoming awakened, and people are I do believe that there is going to be change, meaningful change for the better. It might take 10 or 20 years. I hope it doesn't, but it will. But I'm seeing people become more committed to making the world a better place. And I got snapped out of complacency, I promise. And I I hope that I can follow through on that. And I think I'm seeing that in other people, and I'm going to take hope and solace in that.
And I think that's wonderful. And before I turn to Robin, and he and our members may not know, the Boston Celtics, behind your leadership and Steve Pagliuca and some others, have made a significant commitment to this area. Beyond just words and platitudes, that organization has put a flag on the ground and said, this matters. Can you tell us just very briefly a little bit about that so that Robin and others could hear?
Oh, well, thank you for asking. I'll be very brief. We have made a commitment both at the NBA level and then at the Celtics level to put very significant resources behind what we're calling Celtics United. And it does involve corporate partners such as JetBlue also signing on and becoming engaged over time, which we appreciate. But it's to really try to make a difference for the better. And Steve Pagliuca has been the leader of it on our side, along with our players and Allison Feaster and Dave Hoffman on our staff. And so there are many people turning our attention to it. And the entire ownership of the NBA in partnership with the players is trying to do the NBA Cares initiative as well. So thanks for mentioning it. And the Celtics have been leaders in civil rights, world leaders really, since the true great people ran the Celtics years ago. The first Black player, the first all-Black starting five, and the first Black head coach were all Celtics. And so leading the way. And so if you're trying to help bring that forward, as I am, your obligation and commitment all the way into your DNA needs to be to try to do a good job in that area, and we're trying.
Yet another reason for those of us across the country to cheer on the Boston Celtics for all that you do for the community. So again, thank you. Robin,
everybody on this call is doing it, and thank you for asking about us, but I know there's many people doing much more, but thank you.
No, absolutely. I think it has been a commitment across the board from so many. Robin, I turn to you for the last word, a message of hope from you. What is it that you can leave us with as a positive note?
Well, by the way, just really appreciate everything the Boston Celtics have done to, make a stand and support the issues around racial equality and social justice. And I fully agree. I mean, I feel that it was different this time. And I feel that, by the way, in our world, I talk about the new form of shareholder activism. It's going to be companies that don't have a genuine commitment to this, not just talking about it. And it's funny, one of the things that we talked about JetBlue is that before we sort of issue the proclamations and all of the press releases saying we agree, let's get our own house in order. What are the things that we can do internally to really ensure that we are committed to, a much higher level of performance around the things we need to do to make sure that we are taking care of all of our crew members from all of the communities that we fly to. So I think it is different this time. So I think that's one positive thing. I think the other thing is we will get through this. I think all the new relationships and all the opportunities that some of us have this year that we never thought we would get. So I don't know about other people, but I've got a son at college and another son who'd left college and was at work. And, I thought they were gone forever. And we had an amazing time when they were back with us for 6 months. And, the chance to build those relationships and also appreciate people that maybe do jobs that, if we are honest, we didn't do enough before. So when everyone was sheltering in place and scared to go out, of course, we had healthcare workers in the front line. But, the people that work at our grocery store, those were my heroes. And the chance to not just walk by someone who's stacking a shelf, but say, just thank you for what you're doing and thank you for being there for all of us and keeping the economy and the country going. So I think, as I reflect back at 2020, I think we can all use that to show a greater appreciation of the things that people do around us that perhaps we just walk by and make sure that everyone feels what they're doing is of a special calling and there's a unique value to all of us. And hopefully some of that can stay and rise above the rancor of the very partisan political environment that we find ourselves in today.
I couldn't agree more with either of what you have to say. I think that looking back on this pandemic, we hope that this brings forth positive, meaningful change and that we grow from this, certainly as community, as leaders. So I am heartened to hear from both of you on that. With that, I look at the clock. It is 1:15. I did promise prompt adjournment, as always. So I want to thank WIC for your support and friendship over these years and for joining us and introducing Robin. Robin, for you and your entire team, they've been fantastic to deal with. I appreciate you bringing Donnie in for so many of our members and for you taking the time. So on behalf of Boston College and the Chief Executives Club, thank you to both of you for being here today.
Warren, thank you. WIC, thank you.
Thank you so much.
For our members, this will be available on YouTube starting tomorrow. You also, everyone will get an invitation for our next event a week from tomorrow on October 2nd. Ramon LaGuarta, Chairman, CEO, and President of PepsiCo, will be joining me. He will be introduced by Mike White, the retired CEO, Chairman, and President of DirecTV. So again, thank you, everybody. Stay safe, stay healthy. Go JetBlue and go Celtics. Take care, everyone.
Thank you.
Cheers.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club featuring Robin Hayes, Chair and CEO of JetBlue. To learn more about the Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program at the Carroll School of Management at Boston College, please visit our website at www.bc.edu/CEO Club.